I opened them again. "Hello, dear boy. So good to have you back. But where on earth have you been?" That, of course, was the question. I have spent most of my life untroubled by dreams and, for that matter, hallucinations. No visions of the apocalypse for me. No troubling Jungian icons burbling up from my subconscious. No mysterious recurring images drifting through the history of my unconsciousness. Nothing ever goes bump in Dexter's night. When I go to sleep, all of me sleeps. So what had just happened? Why were these pictures appearing to me? I splashed water on my face and pushed my hair down. That did not, of course, answer the question, but it made me feel a little better. How bad could things be if my hair was neat? In truth, I didn't know. Things could be plenty bad. I might be losing all or many of my marbles. What if I had been slipping into insanity a piece at a time for years, and this new killer had simply triggered the final headlong fall into complete craziness? How could I hope to measure the relative sanity of somebody like me? The images had looked and felt so real, but they couldn't be. I had been right here in my bed. Yet I had almost been able to smell the tang of salt water, exhaust, and cheap perfume floating over Biscayne Boulevard. Completely real. And wasn't that one of the signs of insanity? That the delusions were indistinguishable from reality? I had no answers and no way to find any. Talking to a shrink was out of the question, of course. I would frighten the poor thing to death, and he might feel honor-bound to have me locked away somewhere. Certainly I could not argue with the wisdom of that idea. But if I was losing my hold on sanity as I had built it, it was all my problem. And the first part of the problem was that there was no way to know for sure. Although, come to think of it, there was one way. 10 minutes later, I was driving past Dinner Key. I drove slowly, since I didn't actually know what I was looking for. This part of the city slept as much as it ever did. A few people still swirled across the Miami landscape. Tourists who'd had too much Cuban coffee and couldn't sleep. People from Iowa looking for a gas station. Foreigners looking for South Beach. And the predators, of course. Thugs, robbers, crackheads, vampires, ghouls, and assorted monsters like me. But in this area, at this time, very few of them altogether. This was Miami deserted, as deserted as it got, a place made lonely by the ghost of the daytime crowd. It was a city that had whittled itself down to a mere hunting ground, without the gaudy disguises of sunlight and bright T-shirts. And so I hunted. The other night eyes tracked me and dismissed me as I passed without slowing. I drove north, over the old drawbridge, through downtown Miami, still not sure what I was looking for, and still not seeing it. And yet, for some uncomfortable reason, absolutely sure that I would find it, that I was going in the right direction, that it was waiting for me ahead. Just beyond the Omni, the nightlife picked up. More activity, more things to see. Whooping on the sidewalks, tinny music coming and going through the car windows. The night girls came out, flocks of them on the street corners, giggling with each other, or staring stupidly at the passing cars. And the cars slowed to stare back, gawking at the costumes and what they left uncovered. 2 blocks ahead of me, a new corniche stopped, and a pack of girls flew out of the shadows, off the sidewalk, and into the street, surrounding the car immediately. Traffic stumbled to a half stop, horns blattered. Most of the drivers sat for a minute, content to watch, but an impatient truck pulled around the knot of cars and into the oncoming lane. A refrigerator truck. "This was nothing," I said to myself. "Nighttime yogurt delivery. Pork link sausages for breakfast. Freshness guaranteed." A load of grouper headed north or to the airport. Refrigerated trucks moved through Miami around the clock, even now, even in the night hours. This it was, and nothing more. But I put my foot down on the gas pedal anyway. I moved up, in and out of traffic. I got within 3 cars of the Corniche and its besieged driver. Traffic stopped. I looked ahead at the truck. It was running straight up Biscayne, moving into a series of traffic lights. I would lose him if I got too far behind. And I suddenly wanted very badly not to lose him. I waited for a gap in traffic and quickly nosed out into the oncoming lane. I was around the Corniche and then speeding up, closing on the truck. Try not to move too fast, not to be conspicuous, but slowly closing the space between us. He was 3 traffic lights ahead, then 2. Then his light turned red, and before I could gloat and catch up, mine did too. I stopped. I realized with some surprise that I was chewing on my lip. I was tense. Me, Dexter, the ice cube. I was feeling human anxiety, desperation, actual emotional distress. I wanted to catch up to this truck and see for myself. Oh, how I wanted to put my hand on the truck, open the door to the cabin, look inside. And then what? Arrest him, single-handedly? Take him by the hand to dear Detective LaGuerta? See what I caught? Can I keep him? It was just as likely that he would keep me. He was in full hunting mode, and I was merely tagging along behind him like an unwanted little brother. And why was I tagging along? Did I just want to prove to myself that it was him, the him, that he was out here prowling and I was not crazy? And if I was not crazy, how would I know? What was going on in my brain? Perhaps crazy would be a happier solution after all. An old man shuffled in front of my car, crossing the street with incredibly slow and painful steps. For a moment I watched him, marveling at what life must be like when you move that slow. And then I glanced ahead at the refrigerator truck. His light had turned green. Mine had not. The truck accelerated quickly, moving north at the upper end of the speed limit, taillights growing smaller as I watched, waiting for my light to change. Which it refused to do. And so, grinding my teeth, steady, Dex, I ran the light, narrowly missing the old man. He didn't look up or break step. The speed limit on this stretch of Biscayne Boulevard was 35. In Miami, that means if you go under 50, they'll run you off the road. I pushed up to 65, moving through the sparse traffic, desperate now to close the distance. The lights of the truck winked out as he went around a curve. Or had he turned? I moved up to 75 and roared past the turn for the 79th Street Causeway, around the bend by the Publix Market, and into the straightaway, searching frantically for the truck. And saw it. There, ahead of me. Moving toward me. The bastard had doubled back. Did he feel me on his tail? Smell my exhaust drifting up on him? No matter. It was him. The same truck. No question. And as I raced past him, he turned out onto the causeway. I squealed into a mall parking lot and slowed, turning the car and accelerating back out onto Biscayne Boulevard, southbound now. Less than a block, and I turned onto the causeway too. Far, far in front, nearly to the first bridge, I saw the small red lights, winking, mocking me. My foot crashed down on the gas pedal, and I charged ahead. He was on the upslope of the bridge now, picking up speed, keeping the distance steady between us, which meant he must know, must realize somebody was following. I pushed my car a little harder. I got closer, little by little, a few lengths closer. And then he was gone, over the hump at the top of the bridge and down the far side, heading much too fast into North Bay Village. It was a heavily patrolled area. If he went too fast, he would be seen and pulled over, and then I was up on the bridge and onto the hump now, and below me, nothing. Empty road. I slowed, looking in all directions from the vantage point at the top of the bridge. A car moved toward me. Not the truck, just a Mercury Marquis with one smashed fender. I started down the far side of the bridge. At the bottom of the bridge, North Bay Village split off the causeway into two residential areas. Behind a gas station on the left, a row of condos and apartments made a slow circle. To the right were houses, small but expensive. Nothing moved on either side. There were no lights showing, no sign of anything, neither traffic nor life. Slowly I moved through the village. Empty. He was gone. On an island with only one through street, he had lost me. But how? I circled back, pulled off onto the shoulder of the road, and closed my eyes. I don't know why. Perhaps I hoped I might see something again. But I didn't. Just darkness. And little bright lights dancing on the inside of my eyelids. I was tired. I felt stupid. Yes, me. Ditzy Dexter, trying to be Boy Wonder, using my great psychic powers to track down the evil genius, pursuing him in my supercharged crime-fighting vehicle. And in all likelihood, he was simply a stoked-up delivery boy playing macho head games with the only other driver on the road that night. A Miami thing that happened every day to every driver in our fair city. Chase me. You can't catch me. Then the uplifted finger, the waved gun. Ho-hum, and back to work. Just a refrigerated truck, nothing more. Now speeding away across Miami Beach with the heavy metal station ripping from the radio speaker. And not my killer. Not some mysterious bond pulling me out of bed and across the city in the dead of night. Because that was just too silly for words, and far too silly for level-headed, empty-hearted Dexter. I let my head drop onto the steering wheel. How wonderful to have such an authentic human experience. Now I knew what it was like to feel like a total idiot. I could hear the bell on the drawbridge in the near distance, clanging its warning that the bridge was about to go up. Ding, ding, ding. The alarm bell on my expired intellect. I yawned. Time to go home. Go back to bed. Behind me, an engine started. I glanced back. From behind the gas station at the foot of the bridge, he came out fast in a tight circle. He passed me, fishtailing and still accelerating, and through the blur of motion in the driver's window, a shape spun at me, wild and hard. I ducked. Something thumped into the side of my car, leaving behind it the sound of an expensive dent. I waited for a moment, just to be safe. Then I raised my head and looked. The truck was speeding away, crashing the wooden barrier at the drawbridge and powering through, leaping across the bridge as it started to raise up, and making it easily to the other side as the bridge keeper leaned out and yelled. Then the truck was gone, down the far side of the bridge and back into Miami, far away on the other side of the widening gap as the bridge went up. Gone. Hopelessly gone. Gone as if he had never been. And I would never know if it had been my killer or just another normal Miami jerk. I got out of my car to look at the dent. It was a big one. I looked around to see what he had thrown. It had rolled 10 or 15 feet away and wobbled out into the middle of the street. Even from this distance, there was no mistaking it. But just to make sure I was absolutely without any doubt, the headlights from an oncoming car lit it up. The car swerved and smashed into a hedge, and over the sound of its now constant horn, I could hear the driver screaming. I walked over to the thing to be sure. Yes, indeed. That's what it was. A woman's head. I bent to look. It was a very clean cut. Very nice work. There was almost no blood around the lip of the wound. Thank God, I said, and I realized I was smiling. And why not? Wasn't it nice? I wasn't crazy after all. Chapter 10. At a little after 8 a.m., La Guerta came over to where I was sitting on the trunk of my car. She leaned her tailored haunch onto the car and slid over until our thighs were touching. I waited for her to say something, but she didn't seem to have any words for the occasion. Neither did I. So I sat there for several minutes, looking back at the bridge, feeling the heat of her leg against mine, and wondering where my shy friend had gone with his truck. But I was yanked out of my quiet daydream by a pressure on my thigh. I looked down at my pants leg. La Guerta was kneading my thigh as if it were a lump of dough. I looked up at her face. She looked back. "They found the body," she said. "You know, the rest of it that goes with the head." I stood up. "Where?" She looked at me the way a cop looks at somebody who finds corpseless heads in the street. But she answered. "Office Depot Center," she said. "Where the Panthers play?" I asked, and a little icy-fingered jolt ran through me. "On the ice?" La Guerta nodded, still watching me. "The hockey team," she said. "Is that the Panthers?" "I think that's what they're called," I said. I couldn't help myself. She pursed her lips. "They found it stuffed into the goalie's net." "Visitors or home?" I asked. She blinked. "Does that make a difference?" I shook my head. "Just a joke, detective." "Because I don't know how to tell the difference. I should get somebody there who knows about hockey," she said, her eyes finally drifting away from me and across the crowd, searching for somebody carrying a puck. "I'm glad you can make a joke about it," she added. "What's a..." She frowned, trying to remember. "A samboli?" "A what?" She shrugged. "Some kind of machine. They use it on the ice." "A zamboni?" "Whatever. The guy who drives it. He takes it out on the ice to get ready for practice this morning. A couple of the players, they like to get there early. And they like the ice fresh, so this guy, the..." She hesitated slightly. "The samboli driver? He comes in early on practice days. And so he drives this thing out onto the ice, and he sees these packages stacked up down there in the goalie's net. So he gets down and he takes a look." She shrugged again. "Dokes is over there now. He says they can't get the guy to calm down enough to say any more than that." "I know a little about hockey," I said. She looked at me again with somewhat heavy eyes. "So much I don't know about you, Dexter. You play hockey?" "No, I never played," I said modestly. "I went to a few games." She didn't say anything, and I had to bite my lip to keep from blathering on. In truth, Rita had season tickets for the Florida Panthers, and I had found to my very great surprise that I liked hockey. It was not merely the frantic, cheerfully homicidal mayhem I enjoyed. There was something about sitting in the huge, cool hall that I found relaxing, and I would happily have gone there even to watch golf. In truth, I would have said anything to make La Guerta take me to the rink. I wanted to go to the arena very badly. I wanted to see this body stacked in the net on the ice more than anything else I could think of. Wanted to undo the neat wrapping and see the clean, dry flesh. I wanted to see it so much that I felt like a cartoon of a dog on point. Wanted to be there with it so much that I felt self-righteous and possessive about the body. "All right," La Guerta finally said, when I was about to vibrate out of my skin, and she showed a small, strange smile that was part official and part... what? Something else altogether. Something human, unfortunately, putting it beyond my understanding. "Give us a chance to talk." "I'd like that very much," I said, absolutely oozing charm. La Guerta didn't respond. Maybe she didn't hear me. Not that it mattered. She was totally beyond any sense of sarcasm where her self-image was concerned. It was possible to hit her with the most horrible flattery in the world, and she would accept it as her due. I didn't really enjoy flattering her. There's no fun where there's no challenge. But I didn't know what else to say. What did she imagine we would talk about? She had already grilled me mercilessly when she first arrived on the scene. We had stood beside my poor dented car and watched the sun come up. She had looked out across the causeway and asked me 7 times if I had seen the driver of the truck, each time with a slightly different inflection, frowning in between questions. She'd asked me 5 times if I was sure it had been a refrigerated truck. I'm sure that was subtlety on her part. She wanted to ask about that one a lot more, but held back to avoid being obvious. She even forgot herself once and asked in Spanish. I told her I was seguro, and she had looked at me and touched my arm, but she didn't ask again. And three times she had looked up the incline of the bridge, shaken her head and spat puta under her breath. Clearly that was a reference to Officer Puta, my dear sister Deborah. In the face of an actual refrigerator truck, as predicted by Deborah, a certain amount of spin control was going to be necessary, and I could tell by the way LaGuerta nibbled at her lower lip that she was hard at work on the problem. I was quite sure she would come up with something uncomfortable for Deb. It was what she did best. But for the time being, I was hoping for a modest rise in my sister's stock. Not with LaGuerta, of course, but one could hope that others might notice that her brilliant bit of attempted detective work had panned out. Oddly enough, LaGuerta didn't ask me what I had been doing driving around at that hour. Of course, I'm not a detective, but it did seem like a rather obvious question. Perhaps it would be unkind to say that the oversight was typical of her, but there it is. She just didn't ask. And yet there was more for us to talk about, apparently. So I followed her to her car, a big 2-year-old light blue Chevrolet that she drove on duty. After hours, she had a little BMW that nobody was supposed to know about. "Get in," she said, and I climbed into the neat blue front seat. LaGuerta drove fast, in and out of traffic, and in a very few minutes we were over the causeway to the Miami side again, across Biscayne and a half mile or so to I-95. She drove onto the freeway and wove north through traffic at speeds that seemed a little much, even for Miami. But we got to 595 and turned west. She looked at me sideways out of the corner of her eye, three times before she finally spoke. "That's a nice shirt," she said. I glanced down at my nice shirt. I had thrown it on to chase out of my apartment and saw it now for the first time, a polyester bowling shirt with bright red dragons on it. I'd worn it all day at work, and it was a trifle ripe, but yes, more or less clean-looking. Somewhat nice, of course, but still. Was LaGuerta making small talk so I would relax enough to make some damaging admission? Did she suspect that I knew more than I was saying and think she could get me to drop my guard and say it? "You always wear such nice clothes, Dexter," she said. She looked over at me with a huge, goofy smile, unaware that she was about to ram her car into a tanker truck. She looked back in time and turned the wheel with one finger, and we slid around the tanker and west on I-595. I thought about the nice clothes that I always wore. Well, of course I did. I took pride in being the best-dressed monster in Dade County. Yes, certainly, he chopped up that nice Mr. Duarte, but he was so well-dressed. Proper clothing for all occasions. By the way, what did one wear to attend an early morning decapitation? A day-old bowling shirt and slacks, naturally. I was a la mode. But aside from this morning's hasty costume, I really was careful. It was one of Harry's lessons. Stay neat, dress nicely, avoid attention. But why should a politically-minded homicide detective either notice or care? It was not as if... or was it? A nasty little idea began to grow. Something in the strange smile that flicked across her face and then away gave me the answer. It was ridiculous, but what else could it be? LaGuerta was not looking for a way to put me off my guard and ask more penetrating questions about what I had seen. And she didn't truly give a winged fart about my hockey expertise. LaGuerta was being social. She liked me. Here I was, still trying to recover from the horrible shock of my bizarre, lurching, slobbering attack on Rita. And now this. LaGuerta liked me? Had terrorists dumped something in the Miami water supply? Was I exuding some kind of strange pheromone? Had every woman in Miami suddenly realized how hopeless real men are, and I had become attractive by default? What, in all seriousness, the hell was going on? Of course, I could be wrong. I lunged at the thought like a barracuda at a shiny silver spoon. After all, what colossal egotism to think that a polished, sophisticated, career-track woman like La Guerta might show any kind of interest in me. Wasn't it more likely that what? As unfortunate as it was, it did make a kind of sense. We were in the same line of work, and therefore, conventional cop wisdom said, more likely to understand and forgive each other. Our relationship could survive her cop hours and stressful lifestyle. And although I take no credit for it, I am presentable enough. I clean up good, as we natives like to say. And I had put myself out to be charming to her for several years now. It had been purely political schmoozing, but she didn't have to know that. I was good at being charming, one of my very few vanities. I'd studied hard and practiced long, and when I applied myself, no one could tell I was faking it. I was really very good at sprinkling seeds of charm. Perhaps it was natural that the seeds would eventually sprout. But sprout into this? What now? Was she going to propose a quiet dinner some evening? Or a few hours of sweaty bliss at the Cacique Motel? Happily, we arrived at the arena just before panic took me over completely. La Guerta circled the building once, looking for the correct entrance. It wasn't too hard to find. A cluster of police cars stood scattered outside one row of double doors. She nosed her big car in among them. I jumped out of the car quickly, before she could put her hand on my knee. She got out and looked at me for a moment. Her mouth twitched. "I'll take a look," I said. I didn't quite run into the arena. I was fleeing La Guerta, yes, but I was also very anxious to get inside, to see what my playful friend had done, to be near his work, to inhale the wonder, to learn. The inside echoed with the organized bedlam typical of any murder scene, and yet it seemed to me that there was a special electricity in the air, a slightly hushed feeling of excitement and tension that you wouldn't find at an ordinary murder, a sense that this one was different somehow, that new and wonderful things might happen because we were out here on the cutting edge. But maybe that was just me. A clot of people stood around the nearby net. Several of them wore Broward uniforms. They had their arms folded and watched as Captain Matthews argued about jurisdiction with a man in a tailored suit. As I got closer, I saw Angel No Relation in an unusual position, standing above a balding man who was on one knee, poking at a stack of carefully wrapped packages. I stopped at the railing to look through the glass. There it was, only 10 feet away. It looked so perfect in the cold purity of the newly zambonied hockey rink. Any jeweler will tell you that finding the right setting is vitally important, and this, it was stunning. Absolutely perfect. I felt just a little dizzy, uncertain of whether the railing would hold my weight, as if I might simply pass straight down through the hard wood, like a mist. Even from the railing, I could tell. He had taken the time. He had done it right. In spite of what must have seemed like a very close call on the causeway only minutes before. Or had he known somehow that I meant him no harm? And since I brought it up anyway, did I, in fact, mean him no harm? Did I truly mean to track him to his lair and come up on point, all a-quiver and advancing Deborah's career? Of course, that was what I thought I was doing. But would I be strong enough to carry through with it if things kept getting so interesting? Here we were at the hockey rink, where I had whiled away many pleasant and contemplative hours. Wasn't this even more proof that this artist, excuse me, I mean killer, of course, was moving on a track parallel to mine? Just look at the lovely work he had done here. And the head. That was the key. Surely it was too important as a piece of what he was doing simply to leave it behind. Had he thrown it to frighten me, send me into paroxysms of terror, horror, and dread? Or had he known somehow that I felt the same way he did? Could he, too, feel the connection between us? And he just wanted to be playful. Was he teasing me? He had to have some important reason for leaving me such a trophy. I was experiencing powerful, dizzying sensations. How could he be feeling nothing? LaGuerta came up beside me. "You're in such a hurry," she said, a slight edge of complaint in her voice. "Are you afraid she'll get away?" She nodded at the stacked body parts. I knew that somewhere inside me was a clever answer, something that would make her smile, charm her a little more, smooth over my awkward run from her clutches. But standing there at the rail, looking down at the body on the ice, in the goalie's net, in the presence of greatness, one might say, no wit came out. I did manage not to yell at her to shut up, but it was a very near thing. "I had to see," I said truthfully, and then recovered enough to add, "It's the home team's net." She slapped my arm playfully. "You're awful," she said. Luckily, Sergeant Doakes came over to us, and the detective didn't have time for a kittenish giggle, which would have been more than I could take. As always, Doakes seemed more interested in finding a way to get a good grip on my ribs and pull me open than anything else, and he gave me such a warm and penetrating look of welcome that I faded quickly away and left him to LaGuerta. He stared after me, watching me with an expression that said I had to be guilty of something, and he would very much like to examine my entrails to find out what. I'm sure he would have been happier someplace where the police were permitted to break the occasional tibia or femur. I circled away from him, moving slowly around the rink to the nearest place where I could get in. I just found it when something came at me on the blind side and hit me, rather hard, in the ribs. I straightened up to face my assailant with a certain bruise and a strained smile. "Hello, dear sister," I said. "So nice to see a friendly face." "Bastard," she hissed at me. "Quite probably," I said, "but why bring it up now?" "Because, you miserable son of a bitch, you had a lead and you didn't call me." "A lead?" I almost stuttered. "What makes you think—" "Cut the crap, Dexter," Deborah snarled. "You weren't driving around at 4 a.m. looking for hookers. You knew where he was, goddammit." Light dawned. I had been so wrapped up in my own problems, starting with the dream, and the fact that it had obviously been something more than that, and continuing on through my nightmarish encounter with LaGuerta, that it didn't occur to me that I had wronged Deborah. I had not shared. Of course she would be angry. "Not a lead, Deb," I said, trying to soothe her feelings a bit. "Nothing solid like that. Just a feeling. A thought, that's all. It was really nothing." She shoved again. "Except that it was something," she snarled. "You found him." "Actually, I'm not sure," I said. "I think he found me." "Quit being clever," she said, and I spread my hands to show how impossible that would be. "You promised, goddamn you." I didn't remember making any kind of promise that might cover calling her in the middle of the night and telling her my dreams, but this didn't seem like a very politic thing to say, so I didn't. "I'm sorry, Deb," I said instead. "I really didn't think it would pan out. It was just a hunch, really." I was certainly not going to attempt any explanation of the parapsychology involved, even with Deb, or perhaps especially not with her. But another thought hit me. I lowered my voice. "Maybe you could help me a little. What am I supposed to tell them if they ever decide to ask me what I was doing driving around down there at 4 a.m.? Has LaGuerta interviewed you yet?" "Exhaustively," I said, fighting down a shudder. Deb made a disgusted face. And she didn't ask. It was not a question. "I'm sure the detective has a great deal on her mind," I said. I didn't add that apparently some of it was me. "But sooner or later, somebody will ask." I looked over to where she was directing the operation. "Probably Sergeant Doakes," I said, with real dread. She nodded. "He's a decent cop. If he could just lose some attitude." "Attitude may be all he is," I said, "but he doesn't like me for some reason. He'll ask anything if he thinks it will make me squirm." "So tell him the truth," Deborah said deadpan. "But first, tell it to me." And she poked me again, in the same spot. "Please, Deb," I said. "You know how easily I bruise." "I don't know," she said, "but I feel like finding out." "It won't happen again," I promised. It was just one of those 3 a.m. inspirations, Deborah. What would you have said if I had called you about it, and then it turned out to be nothing? But it didn't. It turned out to be something, she said, with another push. I really didn't think it would, and I would have felt stupid dragging you in on it. Imagine how I would have felt if he had killed you, she said. It took me by surprise. I couldn't even begin to imagine how she would have felt. Regret? Disappointment? Anger? That sort of thing is way beyond me, I'm afraid. So I just repeated, I'm sorry, Deb. And then, because I am the kind of cheerful Pollyanna who always finds the bright side, I added, but at least the refrigerated truck was there. She blinked at me. The truck was there? She said. Oh, Deb, I said. They didn't tell you? She hit me even harder in the same place. God damn it, Dexter, she hissed. What about the truck? It was there, Deb, I said, somewhat embarrassed by her nakedly emotional reaction, and also, of course, by the fact that a good-looking woman was beating the crap out of me. He was driving a refrigerated truck when he threw the head. She grabbed my arms and stared at me. The fuck you say, she finally said. The fuck I do. Jesus, she said, staring off into space and no doubt seeing her promotion floating there somewhere above my head. And she was probably going to go on, but at that moment, Angel No Relation lifted his voice over the echoing din of the arena. Detective! He called, looking over at LaGuerta. It was a strange, unconscious sound, the half-strangled cry of a man who never makes loud noises in public. And something about it brought instant quiet to the room. The tone was part shock and part triumph. I found something important, but oh my God. All eyes turned to Angel, and he nodded down at the crouching bald man who was slowly, carefully, removing something from the top package. The man finally pulled the thing out, fumbled and dropped it, and it skittered across the ice. He reached for it and slipped, sliding after the brightly gleaming thing from the package until they both came to rest against the boards. Hands shaking, Angel grabbed for it, got it, and held it up for all of us to see. The sudden quiet in the building was awe-inspiring, breathtaking, beautiful, like the overwhelming crash of applause at the unveiling of any work of genius. It was the rearview mirror from the truck. Chapter 11. The great blanket of stunned silence lasted for only a moment. Then the buzz of talk in the arena took on a new note as people strained to see, to explain, to speculate. A mirror. What the hell did it mean? Good question. In spite of feeling so very moved by the thing, I didn't have any immediate theories about what it meant. Sometimes great art is like that. It affects you, and you can't say why. Was it deep symbolism? A cryptic message? A wrenching plea for help and understanding? Impossible to say, and to me, not the most important thing at first. I just wanted to breathe it in. Let others worry about how it had gotten there. After all, maybe it had just fallen off, and he had decided to throw it away in the nearest handy garbage bag. Not possible. Of course not. And now I couldn't help thinking about it. The mirror was there for some very important reason. These were not garbage bags to him. As he had now proved so elegantly with this hockey rink setting, presentation was an important part of what he was doing. He would not be casual in any detail. And because of that, I began to think about what the mirror might mean. I had to believe that, as improvised as it might be, putting it in with the body parts was exceedingly deliberate. And I had the further feeling, burbling up from somewhere behind my lungs, that this was a very careful, very private message. To me? If not me, then whom? The rest of the act was speaking to the world at large. See what I am. See what we all are. See what I am doing about it. A truck's mirror wasn't part of the statement. Segmenting the body, draining the blood, this was necessary and elegant. But the mirror, and especially if it turned out to be from the truck that I had chased, that was different. Elegant, yes. But what did it say about the way things really are? Nothing. It was added on for some other purpose, and that purpose had to be a new and different kind of statement. I could feel the electricity of the thought surging through me. If it was from the truck, it could only be meant for me. But what did it mean? What the hell is that about? Deb said beside me. A mirror. Why? I don't know, I said, still feeling its power throb through me. But I will bet you dinner at Joe's Stone Crabs that it came from the refrigerator truck. No bet, she said, but at least it settles one important question. I looked at her, startled. Could she really have made some intuitive jump that I had missed? What question, sis? She nodded at the cluster of management-level cops still squabbling at the edges of the rink. Jurisdiction. This one is ours. Come on. On the surface, Detective LaGuerta was not impressed with this new piece of evidence. Perhaps she was hiding a deep and abiding concern for the symbolism of the mirror and all it implied under a carefully crafted facade of indifference. Either that, or she really was dumb as a box of rocks. She was still standing with Doakes. To his credit, he looked troubled, but maybe his face had simply gotten tired from its perpetual mean glare, and he was trying something new. Morgan, LaGuerta said to Deb, I didn't recognize you with clothes on. I guess it's possible to miss a lot of obvious things, Detective, Deb said, before I could stop her.
It is, LaGuerta said. That's why some of us never make detective.
It was a complete and effortless victory, and LaGuerta didn't even wait to see the shot go home. She turned away from Deb and spoke to Doakes. Find out who has keys to the arena, who could get in here whenever they wanted. Uh-huh, said Doakes. Check all the locks, see if somebody busted in.
No, LaGuerta told him with a pretty little frown. We got our ice connection now.
She glanced at Deborah.
That refrigerated truck is just to confuse us.
Back to Doakes. The tissue damage had to come from the ice, from here, so the killer is connected to the ice in this place. She looked one last time at Deborah.
Not the truck.
Uh-huh, said Doakes. He didn't sound convinced, but he wasn't in charge. LaGuerta looked over at me.
I think you can go home, Dexter, she said. I know where you live when I need you.
At least she didn't wink. Deborah walked me to the big double doors of the arena.
If this keeps up, I'll be a crossing guard in a year, she grumbled at me.
Nonsense, Deb, I said. 2 months, max.
Thanks.
Well, really, you can't challenge her openly like that. Didn't you see how Sergeant Doakes did it? Have some subtlety, for God's sake.
Subtlety?
She stopped dead in her tracks and grabbed me.
Listen, Dexter, she said. This isn't some kind of game here.
But it is, Deb. A political game, and you're not playing it properly.
I'm not playing anything, she snarled. There are human lives at stake. There's a butcher running loose, and he's going to stay loose as long as that half-wit LaGuerta is running things.
I fought down a surge of hope.
That may be so. It is so, Deb insisted. But Deborah, you can't change that by getting yourself exiled to Coconut Grove traffic duty.
No, she said, but I can change it by finding the killer. Well, there it was. Some people just have no idea how the world works. She was otherwise a very smart person. Truly, she was. She had simply inherited all of Harry's earthy directness, his straightforward way of dealing with things, without latching on to any of his accompanying wisdom. With Harry, bluntness had been a way to cut through the fecal matter. With Deborah, it was a way of pretending there wasn't any. I got a ride back to my car with one of the patrol units outside the arena. I drove home, imagining I had kept the head, wrapped it carefully in tissue paper, and placed it in the back seat to take home with me. Terrible and silly, I know. For the first time, I understood those sad men, usually Shriners, who fondle women's shoes or carry around dirty underwear. An awful feeling that made me want to shower almost as much as I wanted to stroke the head. But I didn't have it. Nothing for it but to go home. I drove slowly, a few miles per hour under the speed limit.
In Miami, that's like wearing a kick me sign on your back. No one actually kicked me, of course. They would have had to slow down for that. But I was honked at 7 times, flipped off 8, and 5 cars simply roared around me, either onto the sidewalk or through oncoming traffic. But today, even the energetic high spirits of the other drivers couldn't cheer me. I was dead tired and bemused, and I needed to think, away from the echoing din of the arena and the bonehead blather of La Guerta. Driving slowly gave me time to wonder, to work through the meaning of all that had happened, and I found that one silly phrase kept ringing in my head, bouncing off the rocks and crannies of my exhausted brain. It took on a life of its own. The more I heard it in my thoughts, the more sense it made. And beyond sense, it became a kind of seductive mantra. It became the key to thinking about the killer, the head rolling into the street, the rearview mirror tucked away amid the wonderfully dry body parts. If it had been me. As in, if it had been me, what would I be saying with the mirror? And if it had been me, what would I have done with the truck? Of course, it had not been me, and that kind of envy is very bad for the soul. But since I was not aware of having one, it didn't matter. If it had been me, the truck would be run into a ditch somewhere not too far from the arena. And then I would get far away from there, fast. In a stashed car? A stolen one? It would depend. If it had been me, would I have planned on leaving the body at the arena all along? Or had that come up as a response to the chase on the causeway? Except that made no sense. He couldn't have counted on anyone chasing him out to North Bay Village, could he? But then why did he have the head ready to throw? And then why take the rest to the arena? It seemed like an odd choice. Yes, there was a great deal of ice there, and the coldness was all to the good, but the vast, clattery space was really not appropriate for my kind of intimate moment, if it had been me. There was a terrible, wide-open desolation that was not at all conducive to real creativity. Fun to visit, but not a real artist's studio. A dumping ground, and not a workspace. It just didn't have the proper feeling to it. If it had been me, that is. So the arena was a bold stroke into unexplored territory. It would give the police fits, and it would most definitely lead them in the wrong direction. If they ever figured out that there was a direction to be led in, which seemed increasingly unlikely. And to top it off with the mirror, if I was right about the reasons for selecting the arena, then the addition of the mirror would, of course, support that. It would be a comment on what had just happened, connected to leaving the head. It would be a statement that would bring together all the other threads, wrap them up as neatly as the stacked body parts, an elegant underlining to a major work. Now, what would the statement be if it was me? I see you. Well, of course that was it, in spite of being somewhat obvious. I see you. I know you're behind me, and I am watching you. But I am far ahead of you, too, controlling your course and setting your speed and watching you follow me. I see you. I know who you are and where you are, and all you know about me is that I am watching. I see you. That felt right. Why didn't it make me feel better? Further, how much of this should I tell poor dear Deborah? This was becoming so intensely personal that it was a struggle to remember that there was a public side to it, a side that was important to my sister and her career. I couldn't begin to tell her, or anyone, that I thought the killer was trying to tell me something, if I had the wit to hear and reply. But the rest, was there something I needed to tell her? And did I actually want to? It was too much. I needed sleep before I could sort all this out. I didn't quite whimper as I crawled into my bed, but it was a very near thing. I allowed sleep to roll over me quickly, just letting go into the darkness. And I got nearly 2.5 full hours of sleep before the telephone rang. "It's me," said the voice on the other end. "Of course it is," I said. "Deborah, wasn't it?" And of course it was. I found the refrigerated truck. Well, congratulations, Deb. That's very good news. There was a rather long silence on the other end. Deb, I said finally, that is good news, isn't it? No, she said. Oh. I felt the need for sleep thumping my head like carpet beaters on a prayer rug, but I tried to concentrate. Deb, what did you... What happened? I made the match, she said, made absolutely certain. Pictures and part numbers and everything. So I told La Guerta like a good scout. And she didn't believe you? I asked incredulously. She probably did. I tried to blink, but my eyes wanted to stick shut, so I gave it up. I'm sorry, Deb. One of us isn't making much sense. Is it me? I tried to explain it to her, Deborah said in a very small, very tired voice that gave me a terrible feeling of sinking under the waves without a bailing bucket. I gave her the whole thing. I was even polite. That's very good, I said. What did she say? Nothing, Deb said. Nothing at all? Nothing at all, Deb repeated. Except she just says thanks, in the kind of way like you'd say it to the valet parking attendant. And she gives me this funny little smile and turns away. Well, but Deb, I said, you can't really expect her to. And then I found out why she smiled like that, Deb said. Like I'm some kind of unwashed half-wit, and she's finally figured out where to lock me up. Oh, no, I said. You mean you're off the case? We're all off the case, Dexter, Deb said, her voice as tired as I felt. La Guerta's made an arrest. There was far too much silence on the line all of a sudden, and I couldn't think at all, but at least I was wide awake. What? I said. La Guerta has arrested somebody, some guy who works at the arena. She has him in custody, and she's sure he's the killer. That's not possible, I said, although I knew it was possible, the brain-dead bitch. La Guerta, not Deb. I know that, Dexter, but don't try to tell La Guerta. She's sure she got the right guy. How sure? I asked. My head was spinning, and I felt a little bit like throwing up. I couldn't really say why. Deb snorted. She has a press conference in 1 hour, she said. For her, that's positive. The pounding in my head got too loud to hear what Deb might have said next. La Guerta had made an arrest? Who? Who could she possibly have tagged for it? Could she truly ignore all the clues, the smell and feel and taste of these kills, and arrest somebody? Because nobody who could do what this killer had done, was doing, could possibly allow a pimple like La Guerta to catch him. Never. I would bet my life on it. No, Deborah, I said. No. Not possible. She's got the wrong guy. Deborah laughed, a tired, dirty-up-to-here cop's laugh. Yeah, she said. I know it. You know it. But she doesn't know it. And you want to know something funny? Neither does he. That made no sense at all. What are you saying, Deb? Who doesn't know? She repeated that awful little laugh. The guy she arrested. I guess he must be almost as confused as La Guerta, Dex, because he confessed. What? He confessed, Dexter. The bastard confessed. Chapter 12. His name was Daryl Earl McHale, and he was what we like to call a two-time loser. 12 of his last 20 years had been spent as a guest of the state of Florida. Dear Sergeant Doakes had managed to dig his name out of the arena's personnel files. In a computer cross-check for employees with a record of violence or felony convictions, McHale's name had popped up twice. Daryl Earl was a drunk and a wife-beater. Apparently, he occasionally knocked over filling stations, too, just for the entertainment value. He could be relied on to hold down a minimum wage job for a month or two. But then some fine Friday night, he'd throw back a few six-packs and start to believe he was the wrath of God. So he'd drive around until he found a gas station that just pissed him off. He'd charge in, waving a weapon, take the money, and drive away. Then he'd use his massive $80 or $90 haul to buy a few more six-packs until he felt so good he just had to beat up on somebody. Darryl Earle was not a large man, 5'6", and scrawny. So to play it safe, the somebody he beat up on usually turned out to be his wife. Things being what they were, he'd actually gotten away with it a couple of times. But one night, he went a little too far with his wife and put her into traction for a month. She pressed charges, and since Darryl Earle already had a record, he'd done some serious time. He still drank, but he'd apparently been frightened enough at Rayford to straighten out just a bit. He'd gotten a job as a janitor at the arena and actually held on to it. As far as we could tell, he hadn't beaten up his wife for ages. And more, our boy had even had a few moments of fame when the Panthers made their run at the Stanley Cup. Part of his job had been to run out and clean up when the fans threw objects on the ice. That Stanley Cup year, this had been a major job, since every time the Panthers scored, the fans threw 3,000 or 4,000 plastic rats onto the rink. Darryl Earle had to schlep out and pick them all up. Boring work, no doubt. And so, encouraged by a few snorts of very cheap vodka one night, he'd picked up one of the plastic rats and done a little rat dance. The crowd ate it up and yelled for more. They began to call for it when Darryl Earle skidded out onto the ice. Darryl Earle did the dance for the rest of the season. Plastic rats were forbidden nowadays. Even if they had been required by a federal statute, nobody would have been throwing them. The Panthers hadn't scored a goal since the days when Miami had an honest mayor, sometime in the last century. But McHale still showed up at the games, hoping for one last on-camera two-step. At the press conference, LaGuerta played the part beautifully. She made it sound like the memory of his small fame had driven Darryl Earle over the edge into murder. And of course, with his drunkenness and his record of violence toward women, he was the perfect suspect for this series of stupid and brutal murders. But Miami's hookers could rest easy. The killing was over. Driven by the overwhelming pressure of an intense and merciless investigation, Darryl Earle had confessed. Case closed. Back to work, girls. The press ate it up. You couldn't really blame them, I suppose. LaGuerta did a masterful job of presenting just enough fact, colored with high-gloss wishful thinking, that nearly anyone would have been convinced. And of course, you don't actually have to have an IQ test to become a reporter. Even so, I always hope for just the smallest glimmer. And I'm always disappointed. Perhaps I saw too many black-and-white movies as a child. I still thought the cynical, world-weary drunk from the large Metropolitan Daily was supposed to ask an awkward question and force the investigators to carefully re-examine the evidence. But sadly, life does not always imitate art. And at LaGuerta's press conference, the part of Spencer Tracy was played by a series of male and female models with perfect hair and tropical weight suits. Their penetrating questions amounted to, "How did it feel to find the head?" and "Can we have some pictures?" One lone reporter, Nick something from the local NBC TV affiliate, asked LaGuerta if she was sure McHale was the killer. But when she said that the overwhelming preponderance of evidence indicated that this was the case, and anyway the confession was conclusive, he let it go. Either he was satisfied, or the words were too big. And so there it was. Case closed. Justice done. The mighty machinery of Metro Miami's awesome crime-fighting apparatus had once again triumphed over the dark forces besieging our fair city. It was a lovely show. LaGuerta handed out some very sinister-looking mugshots of Darryl Earle, stapled to those new glossy shots of herself investigating a $250-an-hour high-fashion photographer on South Beach. It made a wonderfully ironic package. The appearance of danger and the lethal reality. So very different. Because however coarse and brutal Darryl Earle looked, the real threat to society was LaGuerta. She had called off the hounds, closed down the hue and cry, sent people back to bed in a burning building. Was I the only one who could see that Darryl Earle McHale could not possibly be the killer? that there was a style and wit here that a brickhead like Mikhail couldn't even understand? I had never been more alone than I was in my admiration for the real killer's work. The very body part seemed to sing to me, a rhapsody of bloodless wonder that lightened my heart and filled my veins with an intoxicating sense of awe. But it was certainly not going to interfere with my zeal in capturing the real killer, a cold and wanton executioner of the innocent who absolutely must be brought to justice. Right, Dexter? Right? Hello? I sat in my apartment, rubbing my sleep-crusted eyes and thinking about the show I had just watched. It had been as near perfect as a press conference could be without free food and nudity. La Guerta had clearly pulled every string she had ever gotten a hand on in order to make it the biggest, splashiest press conference possible. And it had been. And for perhaps the first time in her Gucci-licking career, La Guerta really and truly believed she had the right man. She had to believe it. It was kind of sad, really. She thought she had done everything right this time. She wasn't just making political moves. In her mind, she was cashing in on a clean and well-lit piece of work. She'd solved the crime, done it her way, caught the bad guy, stopped the killing. Well-earned applause all around for a job well done. And what a lovely surprise she would get when the next body turned up. Because I knew with no room for doubt that the killer was still out there. He was probably watching the press conference on Channel 7, the channel of choice for people with an eye for carnage. At the moment, he would be laughing too hard to hold a blade. But that would pass. And when it did, his sense of humor would no doubt prompt him to comment on the situation. For some reason, the thought did not overwhelm me with fear and loathing and a grim determination to stop this madman before it was too late. Instead, I felt a little surge of anticipation. I knew it was very wrong, and perhaps that made it feel even better. Oh, I wanted this killer stopped. Brought to justice, yes, certainly. But did it have to be soon? There was also a small trade-off to make. If I was going to do my little part to stop the real killer, then I should at least make something positive happen at the same time. And as I thought it, my telephone rang. "Yes, I saw it," I said into the receiver. "Jesus," said Deborah on the other end. "I think I'm going to be sick." "Well, I won't mop your fevered brow, sis. There's work to be done." "Jesus," she repeated. Then, "What work?" "Tell me," I asked her. "Are you in ill odor, sis?" "I'm tired, Dexter, and I'm more pissed off than I've ever been in my life. What's that in English?" "I'm asking if you are in what Dad would have called the doghouse. Is your name Mud in the department? Has your professional reputation been muddied, damaged, sullied, colored, rendered questionable? Between La Guerta's backstabbing and the Einstein thing, my professional reputation is shit." She said with more sourness than I would have thought possible in someone so young. "Good. It's important that you don't have anything to lose." She snorted. "Glad I could help. 'Cause I'm there, Dexter. If I sink any lower in the department, I'll be making coffee for community relations. Where is this going, Dex?" I closed my eyes and leaned all the way back in my chair. "You are going to go on record, with the captain and the department itself, as believing that Daryl Earl is the wrong man and that another murder is going to take place. You will present a couple of compelling reasons culled from your investigation, and you will be the laughingstock of Miami Metro for a little while." "I already am," she said. "No big deal. But is there some reason for this?" I shook my head. It was sometimes hard for me to believe she could be so naive. "Sister dearest," I said, "you don't truly believe Daryl Earl is guilty, do you?" She didn't answer. I could hear her breathing, and it occurred to me that she must be tired, too. Every bit as tired as I was, but without the jolt of energy I got from being certain I was right. "Deb?" "The guy confessed, Dexter," she said at last, and I heard the utter fatigue in her voice. I've been wrong before, even when... I mean... But he confessed. Doesn't that... That... Shit. Maybe we should just let it go, Dex. Oh, ye of little faith, I said. She's got the wrong guy, Deborah. And you are now going to rewrite the politics. Sure I am. Daryl Earl McHale is not it, I said. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Even if you're right, so what? She said. Now it was my turn to blink and wonder. Excuse me? Well, look. If I'm this killer, why don't I realize I'm off the hook now? With this other guy arrested, the heat's off, you know? Why don't I just stop? Or even take off for someplace else and start over? Impossible, I said. You don't understand how this guy thinks. Yeah, I know, she said. How come you do? I chose to ignore that. He's going to stay right here, and he's going to kill again. He has to show us all what he thinks of us. Which is what? It's not good, I admitted. We've done something stupid by arresting an obvious twinkie like Daryl Earl. That's funny. Ha ha, Deb said with no amusement. But we've also insulted him. We've given this lowbrow, brain-dead redneck all the credit for his work, which is like telling Jackson Pollock your 6-year-old could have painted that. Jackson Pollock? The painter? Dexter, this guy's a butcher. In his own way, Deborah, he's an artist, and he thinks of himself that way. For Christ's sake, that's the stupidest... Trust me, Deb. Sure I trust you. Why shouldn't I trust you? So we have an angrily amused artist who's not going anywhere, right? Right, I said. He has to do it again, and it has to be under our noses, and it probably has to be a little bigger. You mean he's going to kill a fat hooker this time? Bigger in scale, Deborah. Larger in concept. Splashier. Oh, splashier. Sure, like with a mulcher. The stakes have gone up, Debs. We've pushed him and insulted him a little, and the next kill will reflect that. Uh-huh, she said. And how would that work? I don't really know, I admitted. But you're sure. That's right, I said. Swell, she said. Now I know what to watch for.
This ends Disc 3.